Welcome to For the Long Run, the podcast exploring the why behind what keeps runners running long, strong, and motivated. I'm your host, Jonathan Levitt. Through personal and professional connections in the running world, I have the privilege of getting to know some amazing athletes. I've always been fascinated by the psychological aspect of running, and this podcast is aimed at exploring this and much more. I hope you enjoy. Have you guys heard of Beam? I have been absolutely loving their products lately. Beam is a CBD company that's making waves in the running world by offering products that combine THC-free CBD with other high-quality ingredients. It was founded by two ex-professional athletes with the idea that everyone should have the chance to experience what better feels like. Whether you're sore or stressed, Beam is key for recovery and self-care. Try it for yourself with 15% off using the code FTLR from BeamTLC.com. I recommend Beam Dream Powder or the Focus Capsules. Welcome back. I have Ashley Brazovan joining me on the podcast from just down the road. Ashley, thanks so much for taking some time to chat.
Yeah, thanks for having me and welcome to Colorado, where I know you've been here for a while, but I'm recruiting people still to Golden, Colorado.
Yes. To be determined, but yes. Yeah, I feel like the podcast has become I'm making the rounds of the Boulder, Golden, Denver running community again. And it's reminding me of a good year in 2020 where all these conversations were live and in person. So hopefully we can get back to that at some point soon. But in the meantime, we'll share a video chat and maybe a run up here in Breckenridge at some point. But before we dive too far into reminiscing or hyping Colorado, I should get this to be sponsored by the Visit Colorado Tourism Board or whatever it is. first question, who is Ashley?
Well, I know I've listened to so many of your podcasts, so I knew this one was coming. I feel like there's no good answer, but
every answer is a
runner,
a good answer.
Yes. No, I think there's a variety of different answers, but I actually struggled with defining myself as a runner after college. And so I do now define myself as that, but runner, friend, community member, definitely environmentalist, focusing on climate change and carbon offsets, life partner, friend, all the nouns to describe me.
Nice. Well, you said something there that I want to dive right into, I guess. Why did you find it challenging to define yourself as a runner post-collegiately? And you ran at Duke, right?
Correct. Yeah, so I have a really interesting story. I think coming in high school, I was almost completely defined as a runner or athlete. And I've been running since sixth or seventh grade, which I feel like is not super common once you hit your 30s. You know, you see a lot of people who've had like multi-sport backgrounds. I feel like one of the few people who's like really only ran my whole life. I swam a little bit, but I was always defined as a runner from seventh grade through up until I got to college and came into Duke on a full ride. Which is a lot of pressure. And so I really wanted to define myself as a runner and live up to expectations and had dreams of becoming a professional runner. I'd won three national titles in high school and also was able to compete on the world level and be second for Team USA as a senior in high school. And so I really came in with, you know, running completely, not completely defined me, but was a lot of my background. And so I got injured that I think 2 weeks into college and really struggled the first 2.5 years of college with redefining myself and figuring out who I was outside of just running. And I don't really think I got the answer to this until grad school when I was like, okay, I just need to like, I'm not going to be a professional runner. I've had four stress fractures in 4 years. Who am I? And I think I'm still figuring that out a little bit, but I think there's a lot of pieces of me that have kind of come to the forefront outside of running, especially since college and all those injuries happened. And I think that came together really for me in grad school, where I really focused on my career in the environmental field. And I realized that people liked me for who I was outside of just running and my performances and goals. And I think that was something that really scared me coming off of a super successful high school career. And I think it's an evolving thing of how you define yourself, and it's different. It's looked different every year, honestly, but I can truly say running is part of me, but it's not all of me anymore. Like it was 12 years ago.
Yeah, I think that's important. And I think the balance as a human versus a human who runs versus a runner who is a human is important. The first podcast I released was with Ben Rosario, and Ben talked about how if running is the only thing you have, I feel bad for you, is what he said. Because what happens when it's taken away? What happens when you're injured? What happens when what you define yourself as is removed? And I think a lot of us have dealt with that and been forced to deal with that, whether it's injury or the pandemic or a variety of other reasons for, you know, not being able to run or race or travel or whatever it might be that like fills up our cup. So I'm curious how that process or how that experience evolved for you, knowing that you were very successful early on, and you're still successful now, but how have you pivoted to that point where, yes, it's important, yes, it's a piece of your life, but when I asked who is Ashley, it wasn't the only thing that you said.
Right. No, that's a great question. I remember listening to your first episode, actually, of this podcast with Ben, and I really love his approach to NAS Elite and making sure that he recruits a well-balanced team. I give Hoka, NAS Elite, and Ben like a kudos for just building such a strong culture that's very balanced. And I probably, like most lifelong runners, was kind of forced into that balance. So I did have 4 femoral stress fractures in college. And I just remember my freshman year, I came on and I had a lot of long-term support from Duke. And my coach was essentially like, if you want to run the rest of your life, you need to find things outside of running. You need to, you know, get some help either through therapy or through other means and figure out the mental situation of dealing with injury. I also had osteoporosis at 18. So it was like, you definitely need to figure out your physical health situation as well, because if you have osteoporosis, and it was like not just osteoporosis, it was like way off the deep end, like you it's going to take years to overcome this. He's like, if you ever really want to run again, you're going to need to like take a hard look at your life, and it's probably worth looking at things that make you happy outside of running. So I think being told that as an 18-year-old was definitely, I'd put that in the forced category of trying to find balance. And I think it was definitely a process, like just to process all of that information, having not only just like qualitative data of like people telling me that I was kind of deep in a hole, but also having the numbers to back it up from a health perspective. And you're with Inside Tracker, so you probably see this a lot where you have, you know, blood work done and DEXA scans, and you see the numbers and you're like, okay, the data is telling me like this is what I need to do. And so I think I slowly started, you know, building a community and support system, and then, you know, really realized I've always had a passion for the environment. So I was an environmental major in undergrad and then went to grad school in energy. And that's a big part of my life. Like I love my career and what I do. And I do have a good community out here in Colorado, outside of running, of college friends. And I have a partner that I live with now. And so I think just rebuilding and starting from scratch is really how I created balance. I feel like I kind of started at ground zero and had to rebuild my life, thinking about the fact that I may never get to run again, and what my life could potentially look like without that. I mean, I'm in the situation, you know, 12 years later, where I luckily addressed enough early on where I can be competitive, but I was in the mindset of like this, I may never be able to run again at this point.
What did that feel like?
It was scary when your whole life is kind of turned upside down. and you're on a full ride to do just that, and you don't know if you will ever be able to do that again. I think I grew up really fast, and I think I came to the conclusion that I really wanted to run long term, and I wanted to be able to run when I was 30 and 40, and I didn't need to just like try to keep coming back. And I had a college that supported me in doing that. And so I'm really grateful for that process, but it was scary. And I think I learned a lot, and I learned a lot about myself, and I grew a lot in those 4 years. And it was the hardest 4 years probably of my life so far, but I am who I am today because of that.
So I've spoken with Amelia a lot about her journey. And I don't want to say like bottoming out, but getting to a place where you can't keep doing what you're doing and expecting better results. Would you say that you had a similar experience in that, like, this was a, like, did you have that aha moment, or was it just sort of like the culmination, or not culmination, that's the opposite of what I'm trying to say. Or was it just like, you know, all these doctors are saying this, everyone's telling me this, maybe I'll, you know, make some changes.
No, I think it was a similar experience to Amelia. And I've talked to her a little bit about this as well. And it was kind of just like all of a sudden, like all of this came kind of crashing in at the same time. And it really felt like rock bottom. I mean, that's the best way to describe it. And like the only way you can go is up, but it's a lot of work and a lot of time and a lot of patience. And, you know, bone density and eating issues don't change overnight, and I think it's still an ever evolving process for me. But I think, you know, 12 years later, I can say, hey, I think I actually did something right the last 12 years. Like, I do now, all of my numbers are great. Like, I have normal bone density, which is, you know, the other end of the spectrum, I think, especially for female long distance runners, and my blood work is consistently good, and I monitor all of that. But I think just the mental state too, I think the biggest change for me was realizing how much you can't function too when you're so overwhelmed and have all of these things going on. You're constantly thinking about food. I feel like I can think better, and I can be a better employee and a better friend, and I can hold relationships. And so it's crazy to see the difference when you've really been at rock bottom. It makes you just really appreciate even the little wins or the good moments so much more. And I think you have to be at rock bottom sometimes to be able to be grateful and practice gratitude towards just the little things.
Totally. I just had Emily Infeld on the podcast, and we talked a lot about that. She's had, you know, a couple of years of injury in a row. She cross-trained her way to the Olympics and, you know, is now on the rebound and on a great trajectory at the moment. And what we talked about was that gratitude that, like, sometimes you're at the top of your game and you're setting PRs and you're at the Olympics even, or your own personal Olympics, whatever that might be. And then other times you're doing a, you know, 10-minute run walk, and the same athlete can do both. And the same athlete can be in a place where, you know, that 10 by 1 minute is hard, and that's what their body is accepting in that moment. And then other times, you know, you can run a 32-minute 10K and go to the Olympics. And so I think that balance is, or that like delta is so important. So I'm here in Breckenridge. Every run is a hill. And every hill has a downhill. And I freaking love downhills. And it's like the perfect metaphor for the journey. Like, to get what you want, you have to work and you have to struggle. And you have, like, otherwise it wouldn't be as fun. Like, if I just took a ski lift up to the top of the mountain just so I could bomb down, the bombing down part probably wouldn't be as fun without the little struggle or suffer to get up there. So I think it's an astute observation. And for those who might be struggling in the moment, it does get better and it's okay to be in that moment. But what would you tell, if you could talk to Ashley of 18 to 20 years old, what would you say to her today?
Yeah, well, first of all, I love how you mentioned the ski lift to the top of hills and then running back down. I can tell you've like clearly thought this out on every hill run that you've done in Breckenridge.
Yeah, I mean, like most of my runs are next to ski lifts. So it's like, I could just take it and go up and run down. But anyway.
Yeah, I think, like you said before, I think just enjoying the process is really critical to running, because honestly, the first injury is always the hardest. I see this again and again with runners. You're like, whole world shatters. And I think once you realize everyone gets injured and that that will happen and that's part of the process, it gets easier and easier. I'm not saying people should go out and try to get 6 stress fractures. That's my current count. But honestly, the 6th one was way easier than the first one. The first one, when I was on crutches and you're crying all the time. And the 6th one, I was like, oh, I got this. I know what to do. Right. It's not a big deal. I have the rest of my life to run. So I think just like putting things into perspective. And honestly, I think some of that comes with age too, just going through it again and again. But really, I would tell myself at 18 to stop focusing on goals and outcomes and results. People like you, no matter how fast you run or how slow you run, like you're the one who cares the most. And just enjoy the process and the community and have fun with it, because that's when you'll honestly do your best. And that's when I've done my best, is when I'm happy with running and like with things outside of running too, which my mental happiness is directly correlated to the process and the rest of my life. And I've finally put that together after 20 years of running.
It's so wild how the stuff outside of running contributes to running. I started seeing a therapist in, I think, 2018, and I saw the best progress in running I'd ever seen in 2019. And my chiropractor reflected on the progress I was making. And Megan also reflected on the progress I was making in a very different way. And I'll share that in a second. But my chiropractor was like, you are doing the work outside of running so that running is just running. Like, people say running is therapy. I wholeheartedly disagree. I think running is therapeutic, but it can't be therapy in the way that therapy can be therapy. So I had those two sort of therapy and therapeutic things happening at the same time. And I was going into runs just like totally free. And my mind would just wander or be locked in on the workout or whatever it was. And that was great. And then Megan's reflection was, there is science to being happy leading to faster recovery. And so I think that when you are able to find a place of happiness, that you can do some cool stuff.
Yeah, totally. And I'm sure you've seen this in races, because I've heard you talk about it a little bit too, where, you know, like your Boston experiences, you do better in your race when you're not overthinking it and you're just super relaxed going in and you're having fun with it. That's when you race the best too. But yeah, I mean, I have 6+ bone injury data points, and I can track all of them back to like a stressful point in my life. Like number 5 was 2 or 3 weeks after my grandpa died, and I flew across the country and like didn't take grieving time from work, didn't take grieving time from running, totally regret that, and got a stress fracture 2 weeks later. And I was like, they're definitely correlated. Most of them have some event, some traumatic event or mentally stressful period that I can trace it directly back to.
Totally. It's the like the Rochism, stress is stress. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter where it comes from. Your body doesn't know the difference. Your body doesn't, as David says all the time, your body doesn't know miles, it knows stress. And I think that reared its ugly head in 2020 and 2021 as well, where, you know, we were trying to, again, as David said, you don't have to be good at a pandemic, you just have to survive it. He said that on the podcast, I believe it was episode 69, back in April of last year. And that is so true. But it's it's the stress of life. It's the stress of jobs. It's the stress of everything that leads to these experiences. And we just have to be mindful of it.
Yeah, which is funny because I think the people who can handle adversity can could handle the pandemic a lot better too. Like, I don't know, I had a pretty like just rough 2019 in general. Just a couple of different like traumatic life events and family deaths and suicides. And so I came into 2020 and it was like, we had the trials and then the pandemic hit and I was like, oh, I got this. I've been through way worse stuff, even just last year. And so actually I've talked to David a lot about this. I was like, I feel like I can ramp up my training because I'm not commuting anymore. I'm not doing in-person client meetings. I'm not traveling for work. Like, I feel like I've been able to deal with it just better. And I think a lot of this is gone. I can contribute to running and just the adversity I've had to face in running and just being able to face that in life too. Like, this has been, I mean, I'm not saying the pandemic has been easy by any stretch of the imagination, but it hasn't been the worst 12 months of my life by a long stretch.
Yeah. I think it's all contextualized, right? It's like, how do you handle or process something? And everybody's ability to process struggles is different. And I think it's a muscle, right? The more you experience it, potentially, as long as you have the tools, the easier it becomes. It's just like training. Like, you wouldn't do the workouts you're doing today. You wouldn't have done them as an 18-year-old, but you can handle them now. And that's true in life. And I think there's a lot of crossover. I forget who said it on this podcast, but they said that running is the ultimate teacher for life. I think it was Karis a couple episodes ago. Running is the greatest teacher for life. And the things that we learn on the roads and trails and track and, you know, whatnot about failure and growth and success, it's just a microcosm of life. You just learn it faster.
No, totally. And I think going back to what you said earlier, like, running shouldn't be a de-stressor or your only de-stressor, because then you're inherently using it as a coping mechanism. And I think that's when people take injuries or adversity the hardest, is when they're reliant upon that one thing as a coping mechanism. And I think that's a big issue within the current running community. And especially when the pandemic hit, is if you're just reliant on running for happiness or a de-stressor, then what happens when you get injured? Like, I've seen people, you know, commit suicide and get super depressed. And you just have to have more buckets of happiness than just running. And just creating that balance and diversification of happiness is just important to mental health and being able to move forward as a human.
Totally agree. So tangential to that, talk to me about your job and how that relates to your love for the outdoors.
Yeah, they go hand in hand. So actually, a lot of trail runners and outdoor enthusiasts obviously work in the environmental field. I originally wanted to be a marine biologist when I was growing up because I grew up in Florida and I've been a scuba diver since I was 10. So I majored in oceanography in undergrad and then decided that wasn't a super practical major and I wasn't going to save every ocean on the planet. So did a 180 and switched to energy management. So right now I work with local governments throughout Colorado. So cities, counties, and special districts on renewable energy and energy efficiency strategy and implementation. So we do all of the engineering, design work, and construction of, we're doing a lot of solar right now that's pretty big in Colorado, and then energy and water efficiency within buildings. So I'm super passionate about it and I love it. And I think I often work with park and rec districts. And since we build our projects, I help with the calculations at the end of like how much carbon we're offsetting with each project. And you know, you can directly tie that into, you saw the forest fires this summer. So looking at tying that into just trail preservation and air quality preservation and being able to do what we love doing outdoors in the future, we just have to focus on some of the carbon emissions now and be more conscious of that. So it's a indirect tie-in to the outdoors.
So if someone's listening and wants to make a small impact, What are your top suggestions?
Yeah, I just think about your own personal footprint. So I know like this year, I mean, I'm still even working on a lot of this, but this year I figured out that I moved to Golden or back to Golden this year, and they have municipal composting. So composting is kind of an easier one if you have access to composting, or you can create your own composting in your yard. But I cut my trash or waste by, I mean, magnitudes because I started composting. Like, you don't realize how much of your food waste, even just like banana peels and eggshells, go into the trash when they could be composted. So, I mean, if you're not there yet, starting with just recycling. Like, I still know a lot of my family's from the South and like on the more conservative side. So I'm just working on them with, hey, if you can just recycle, you know, your water bottles when you use it, better yet, use a reusable water bottle. But I would just say, you know, like anything else in life, start small and do something that's sustainable and that you know you can do. But that's kind of one. And then, you know, just being aware of energy consumption, shutting off your lights when you leave a room, making sure you unplug devices when you leave for vacation. I mean, I could create a whole list. But my overall advice is just start small, do something sustainable, and don't make it a huge life change. You'll get there eventually if you want to.
True in all arenas. You eat an elephant one bite at a time, as they say. The composting thing is wild. I started doing it in Boston. I was finishing a run one day, and I right in my courtyard, and I saw a group called City Compost picking up buckets of compost. And I was like, "What? How much does this cost? Tell me the details, blah, blah, blah." And it's like $10 a month to have somebody come and pick it up in some places. And many places do it for free. And like the city of Cambridge in Massachusetts, I believe, picks it up for free. So I started doing it, and like I would fill up like a, I don't know, 4-gallon bucket in like a week and a half, 2-week period. And that's all stuff that's no longer going in landfills. And so it's wild just how quickly it all adds up. And like you said, it's a small thing that we can all do or attempt to do to make a change. Switching gears quite significantly, one thing that I've enjoyed asking about on the podcast recently is defining success and what you would define success as. So my first question is, what is your definition of success?
Yeah, so I also think about this probably daily. I actually tie success back to my own mental health and happiness. And I think this came out of just being at rock bottom a couple times in the last decade. But I feel like I'm being successful if I'm truly happy and my mental health is above average, which I created my own baseline for this. And I know how often I should have anxiety and different things. Also worked with a therapist for a few years on baselining this. And so just making sure that I don't have anxiety, I'm happy, and I'm giving 100% every day to what I'm doing. And if, you know, those three things are there, I feel like I can be successful on a day-to-day basis. And I think I've thought less about success long-term and just more about success and the little wins every day. I mean, especially during COVID where this future is so uncertain and you just can't plan that far in advance. And so I've just focused more on day-to-day success and little wins. And that's really, I think, helped change my perspective on defining success as a whole.
Yeah, I love that. I think that daily happiness is so important, and it facilitates so much around mental health. I mean, I've had people reach out to me on Twitter and Instagram or text or whatever and say, you look genuinely happy and Colorado looks good on you. And that's what joy looks like. And my wish is that everyone can experience what I'm feeling right now, because I've never felt this way. I've never been in a mental place basically like you just described, like doing things that I find to be valuable and rewarding and finding that joy in the day to day. And I think nature is a huge and understated component of success and happiness, and being able to spend time in nature leads to all of these things. So for those who might not be in that position right now, commit to yourself to like go outside more and go for a walk, or, you know, whatever it might be. Cause I think that helps a ton. Expanding on that a little bit more, let's fast forward 5 to 10 years. What are you really proud of?
I think similar, just giving my best every day and feeling like I'm contributing to society, which I think, I don't know, I hit the 30-year-old milestone 2 months ago. So I think I had all of these things that I wanted to check off or accomplish by 30. And the biggest one was just feeling like I'm giving back to both the running community and like society as a whole. And I do feel like between the volunteer and mentorship opportunities I've done with running, that I am giving back to the sport just because it's given me so much. I mean, it gave me a college education and a huge community and a friend group and a lot of travel. So that piece. And then also, I think through my job, just making sure that I'm waking up every day and feeling like I'm contributing to climate change, positively, obviously, and, you know, just making the world a better place. And if I can look back, I always, this sounds kind of morbid, but if I said, if I died tomorrow, would I be happy with what I accomplished? And if I can say yes to that question, then I am giving my best every day, and I'm still driving towards that goal of creating a better society.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. Thanks again to Beam for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. I take their Dream powder most nights before bed. Dream contains magnesium, a small amount of melatonin, and broad spectrum nano CBD, and always leads to a refreshing night's sleep. I'm also a big fan of their focus capsules for during the day, containing many of the nutrients that I know my body needs, such as ashwagandha, CoQ10, as well as CBD, Focus helps you do exactly that. Visit beamtlc.com and use the code FTLR for 15% off, and let me know what you think. And now, back to our conversation. Talking about the running community, you mentioned it a handful of times. Talking about the community in Golden, the community in Colorado, and how did you foster that feeling of community?
Yeah, I think especially after college, after I'd gone through, you know, so many injuries, and I was just thinking about quitting running altogether. I had come out to Colorado with no intentions of ever really running or competing again. And I refound that love through the community. I was like, these are the people that I'm most similar to and that I can connect with on a deeper level. I mean, so many distance runners just get so deep. It's a super smart group. I'm sure you've experienced this. I feel like everyone I know is, you know, in med school, or they're a doctor or anesthesiologist or attorney, or, you know, they have higher pursuits and goals in all aspects of life. I feel like that's really common in distance runners, since you need so much discipline. And I feel like that just, I really can connect with them on a bunch of different levels. And I've really found that in the Colorado community, where I just have girls and guys that I run with on an ongoing basis that I just connect with their lifestyle, and we get each other. And that was something I think I realized when I moved out to Colorado, that I didn't want to give up, that it's what made me happy and made me a better person for everything else that I do in life.
I love that. I had a conversation with the founder of Boco Gear. And what she said was, out here, people don't try and size you up for your job or your where you went to college or how much money you make. They ask what you do for fun, and how you spend your time outside of work. And I think that it's super cool, the community out here or further west and whatnot, where it's all about the exploration of the outdoors and you know, what we can do with our feet and legs and body. And it's just a different, it's a different vibe. Again, I've got to solicit the Colorado Board of Tourism or something for this podcast, but till then. So talk to me about 2021 and running. What is this weird period of, or weird season look like for you? How are you approaching it?
Yeah. So I have like a plan A through D right now. My plan A already died from race cancellations, but I started the year with project as the pacer, a pacer for Project Carbon X2. Hoka was, did an awesome job putting on that event. And looking back, I was like, should I have just run the whole 100K if all of these spring races are getting canceled? But David probably would not have gone for that. So I probably shouldn't even have pitched the idea to him. But originally that was
what did he say when you brought it up?
Oh, he's nice about it. He's like, I would not recommend doing that, but do whatever you want and what makes you happy. So it's like an indirect no. I know when he like is like, you can do this, but then I know it's not, I shouldn't do it.
So him saying no is very funny because there's the like soft no, and then there's the like, no, this is a bad idea. And I need to tell you that this is a bad idea. And he's only ever once done that for me. I asked about, I think I wanted to run the 52K at Broken Arrow. And he was like, how about we train for a race that you can train for at sea level without massive elevation to train for? And I was like, all right, good point.
And you did the 27K, didn't you? You did the shorter
one. I did the 26K and it took me 3.5 hours. So it was absolutely brutal.
Yeah, it's I don't remember the last time he told me to readjust a plan based on distance. I feel like I got a pretty good grip on what my body can handle, but I was originally using the Hoka Project Carbon X for a tune-up for Sonoma for 50. I was like, I have time. I'm not commuting. Like, this is my one opportunity to like potentially do a 50 miler. And then that got moved to Labor Day. So I don't really know if that's going to be, it's like tentatively on the schedule, but, yeah, I guess my plan B right now is a local Colorado race in May and then probably Mount Washington out in your neck of the woods in the Northeast.
Ooh,
and then, yeah.
That's a grind.
Speed Goat. Yeah, I've run Pikes Peak before and I've done some uphill only races at like 11,000 feet. So I'm not too concerned about it.
What do the women run at that like 49 minutes for the 7 miles? Or
that
something
sounds right. I haven't looked at the time. I don't know if you've been to Golden, but Lookout Mountain here is 7 miles straight up. So it's like perfect training. It's all on road, 7 miles straight up Lookout Mountain, like about, I think it's about the same elevation gain too. So and I can just run there from my house. So
nice.
That's my training plan. Next 4 months, just running Lookout.
Talk about fun downhills.
Yeah, it's actually not as bad as you would think. It's a little more gradual. So people are always like, oh, doesn't the road down hurt? And one, I was a road runner for 4 years before I started trail. So no, it's not as bad as it seems. And it's pretty gradual. So you get used to it. And doing it once every month is nothing.
Talking about something you just mentioned, Project Carbon X 2. I just had... I had Raj Paul on the podcast yesterday and he came in second and talked about the experience of being not in the lead pack, but in sort of the in between the first and second pack and the like calmness that he experienced in the race and on the start line and whatnot. And I was fascinated by that as a competitor. Talking about the experience of pacing such an event where the goals were so insanely high and there was so much importance on nailing the splits early on. Did you feel pressure? Did you feel calm? How was that experience?
Yeah. So Raj, I've not heard his podcast, obviously, because you haven't released it, but I've run with him one or two times in Denver. And I give him so much credit for his race strategy, because it was basically like everyone in the guys pack went out with that lead pack and they were either going to drop out or finish and get the world record. And he really stuck to his race plan and went out conservatively, and he had a lot of guts to do that. So I give him props for that. On the woman's side, I mean, I'm generally a pretty calm person in general, even when it comes to my own racing. I think most people who know me kind of know that too. After 20 years of racing, you just kind of get used to it. And so my goal as a pacer, I was not super nervous. I was just more excited. Like, it was nice to have an event, and they did, you know, we had 3 COVID tests before the event where they all had to come back negative for us to like enter the bubble. And then, so we felt really safe when we were in the bubble. It was like pretty remote in Phoenix, the same place where the Project Marathon or Marathon Project was. So from a safety perspective, like, great job. And it kind of gave you some time to talk to everyone. And for the girl's side, it was like almost a 1-to-1 ratio for pacers to athletes, which was kind of cool. I was the oddball out, funny enough. So I just, Hoka told me to stay with whoever the lead female was. So I didn't really have an assigned pace or pace goal. I kind of was under the assumption, actually, I would go out with Camille, but Carla, the lady from the UK, actually ended up going out at like really quick pace. And so she ended up being in front and I was with her, but it was super fun. I was like, I feel like I really just focused on like, let's do what you need. Like, we did a pre-race meeting the night before. I was like, how can I help you? Like, do you want me to give you, I can't give you gels, but just like, let me know what pace you want. If I'm going too fast, I can like block the wind for you. I can talk to you. I can sing to you, whatever you want. It's your day. And then I just kind of like reminded her to run the tangents, cause that obviously over 62 miles makes a huge difference. And, my full focus was on her. So it was really cool opportunity to, again, like give back to the community, help someone accomplish their goals. And I had so much fun with it. Like, I've paced before and I love pacing. I obviously have my own goals, but it's very rewarding, I think, to help someone else accomplish their own goals and just get pumped up for them.
And what was the pace and distance that you ran?
It was like 6:36 pace. And I ended up going through 24 miles. So this was another David like coach negotiation. He was like, if you go anywhere over 25 miles, we're going to take a week off after this. And if you go under 25 miles, you get to start running again after 2 days. So I was like, okay, 24 point something miles it is.
You didn't want to knock out the what, that's like a 240 something marathon, 245 marathon.
I think it's like 250, but I did think about that. I was like, oh, it would be really cool to just go through. I mean, it wouldn't have been close to a PR. So I was like, but it is, I did look back on it and I was like, whoa, if I just kept running for 2 more miles, I think it's 250 something marathon, which is like kind of crazy because it felt so much more comfortable than my normal marathon pace.
Awesome. We'll have to go out for a jog and you can pace me to a 255 and it'll be a walk in the park for you. And it'll be fun for me. Maybe get me into Boston for once. That's wild. I mean, just like thinking about the consistency that something like that requires and the dialed in nature of running loops for 100K. Raj was talking about, he was like, I'm a little bit of a strange bird where I just love math and thinking about clicking off another lap and another lap and the monotony of doing this over and over again. He was like, I feel like I was the only one that trained on loops. And he's like, everyone else was, you know, these trail runners that came doing all this big vert and climbing. And he's like, I ran a 50K in Washington Park on the road. And that was my training. And it was just a funny observation.
I saw that on his Strava and I was like, oh my God, I don't know how he did 30 miles on that loop. But that will definitely prepare you for what, I mean, it was an interesting loop though. It was not, I think what he did in Wash Park, the 50K in Wash Park was way harder than the 100K with 9 loops. And I don't know, I'm kind of like him where I can kind of click into a gear and just go, yeah, like think about other things. I do a fair amount of running alone in the morning anyway. But I love thinking about like food and like the timing of that too. Like I'm a very math oriented person. So thinking about like, oh, I'll take like a, you know, pomegranate flavored gel at the next one and I should drink water now. And I think if I was running the whole thing, I'd kind of be thinking about splits and pacing and then just like different fun foods.
Fun foods. What was the finish line environment like?
Yeah, I mean, they obviously, it was pretty small since it was really only athletes and pacers. So they had some media on the finish line, but then it was pretty small group. I mean, maybe 20 people, and it was pacers who had already dropped out and then athletes who ended up dropping from the race. I mean, I personally knew a lot of people, so super fun to catch up and just see people that I hadn't seen and connect with them. So like chatting at the finish line and waiting for Jim. And then the last lap when Jim was like on world record pace for the like last 30 minutes, I was like standing on the wall, like waiting for him to finish. It was so close. It's like holding my breath and like shouting up and down. I think the cameras like didn't, I was like on the wall. I'm really surprised no one told me to get off and stop blocking views, but I think they had a drone so they could go on the other side and get me out of the view. But it was like really intense that last lap. I'm so into watching racing and it was, I almost cried actually when Jim finished and he was that close to the world record split. I like teared up a little bit and was like, it took me a while to go up and talk to him afterwards. It's like, I think I need to process these emotions before I can go talk to him.
It's so wild to run that fast and come up that short, but I think it reaffirms something you said earlier, which is like, you're still the same person. People don't care how fast you run. They care. I forget who said it on the podcast, but I think they said, maybe it was Emily Enfield. People don't care how fast you run. They just care that you're happy. And I cannot imagine what he would have been going through in that moment to run for 6+ hours and miss it by seconds. But I vividly remember the announcers talking about a specific question. And the question was, if he gets this, does it change anything for him? And the answer was interesting in that the person who answered it, I forget who answered it, but he said, no, Jim's on another level already physically, but mentally, this could change something, right? Like when you get this close to something that nobody has ever done before or something that you've never done before and you almost get it, the next time you go out, it's attainable, right? Even though nobody's ever done it. But just based on the fact that you've gotten close, it should unlock that next level of like being able to do something. And I think the takeaway there is it's just muscle memory. Like excellence is just being consistent and striving to get better every day. And eventually you have these breakthroughs, but even if you don't, you're still getting better.
Yeah. And I think, you know, honestly, Jim is the type of person who's potentially more fueled off of failure. I know sometimes I work that way too, where failure just makes me hungrier, makes me reevaluate the process and then move forward at a quicker pace. But sometimes you need, and I wouldn't say this is a failure. I mean, I think that was a world record attempt and the current world record was on an insane course that was point to point and wind aided. So right. I think everything being said, I feel like that was the world record effort right there. And if the current world record didn't have, you know, those conditions, Jim would have gotten it. But I think, you know, I've had some bad races where it really makes me, you know, you feel sorry for yourself for a day, but then I've always been able to reevaluate, like restructure my training, talk to my coach and make sure like, what didn't I do? And I think those are the points where you really do, you know, get that continuous feedback loop of you are doing something wrong and there are ways to improve. And sometimes when you win, I think, you know, you don't think about that. And sometimes you have worse races or you plateau after that because you're not thinking of continuous improvement and getting that feedback from that failures sometimes make you think about and reevaluate.
Totally. And then along the same lines, Scott Faubel wrote an essay a few years ago. I think it was after Boston, where he said, if you don't let your failures define you, why would you let your successes define you? And to your point, it's like a race is a data point. It gives you guidance on how to tweak and modify going forward. But we rarely execute the way we want to on race day. And it's almost never a full representation of our full potential. And when it is, it's fantastic and feels amazing. But that's not what's going to happen every time. So it's how do you take a race and learn from it versus say, oh, I won, or oh, I PR'd, I'm a great athlete now, or I'm a better athlete now. Sure, you're a better athlete if you challenge yourself and got the most out of yourself on that day. But I totally agree with his point that we shouldn't define ourselves by those races.
Yeah, because most of the population doesn't either. I mean, runners are a small subset of the population. I think it's always eye-opening talking to my family or some of my friends who know nothing about running, and it just really puts you in check that, you know, the world doesn't revolve around running. It doesn't revolve around any times. Like if I told someone what time I ran in a marathon, they're like, oh, that's cool. I remember talking to my grandma once about my first half marathon, and she was like, well, why didn't you run the full thing? Why did you stop halfway? And stuff like that just puts it into perspective, right?
Yeah.
You can't, you know, you have to relate it back to life and the bigger picture and just lessons learned, because we all do this because we love it. If you don't love it, you shouldn't be doing it. So you need to, you know, take a look when you have failures and successes. They're both just as important, like you said.
Totally. And at the end of the day, people really just don't care. In a good way. A story I've referenced quite a few times in the past, but maybe not recently. So to those that are newly listening to the podcast, this might be a new one, but for those who have listened for a while, you're probably rolling your eyes saying, oh, this Picky Bar story again. After I did Rim to Rim to Rim, I was sitting on the bus waiting to go back to our campground. And I opened a Picky Bars wrapper, and I'm noting the Picky Bars component because if you've ever eaten a Picky Bar, you know how crinkly those wrappers are. So it's making all this noise, and the bus driver turns around and says, no eating on the bus. And I say, ma'am, I'm sorry. I just like ran across the Grand Canyon and back. I'm like pretty hungry. She goes, I don't care. No eating on the bus. And so here I was having just accomplished this physical feat and mental feat that was like totally beyond my capacity to understand what I just did. And here's a woman telling me, I don't care. Listen to the rules. And it's just like, it was the perfect example of, this is what we make of it. And we have to enjoy it. And like the numbers and tangible things are totally meaningless in the grand scheme of things. And it's really just what we learn and get out of it along the way that matters.
Right. No, totally. I mean, yeah, you'll look back on it and in 20, 30 years, you won't remember the time you ran some FKT up a random hill. Who knows what Strava will look like at that point or if it will exist. It's, you know, just for your own personal enjoyment and, you know, your own gratitude and making yourself a better person. You can't focus on the numbers and results. It's really just for you most of the time.
Totally. I think that's a good place to wrap for today. So if people want to follow along with you and your journey, where can we find you?
I would say I'm most active on Strava and Instagram, and it's just Ashley_Brassavan on Instagram. And then you can just look up my name on Strava. I'm occasionally on other methods, but I try to avoid social media to the best of my abilities.
Awesome. Well, Ashley, thanks so much for taking some time to chat, and we'll see you out here very soon.
Yes. Awesome. Thanks, Jonathan.
Of course. That's it for today's episode. Like many long runs, it's sad when it has to end. I hope you join in next week on For the Long Run. And in the meantime, happy trails. If you've enjoyed this episode, it would mean a lot to me if you shared it so that others can find it and enjoy it too.